Welcome to Next Stop. This is a special takeover of the TTT, Talking Transport Transformation, brought to you by TUMI, the Transformative Urban Mobility Initiative. I'm your host, Sanaa Khassouneh, the Youth Ambassador on Inclusion and Sustainable Transport. At Next Stop, every episode is basically a virtual bus ride, purposeful and small. But at the same time, we make few stops along the conversation to pause with our guest, to reflect, to discuss the realities of the transportation system today and how can we make it better, more inclusive and more sustainable. Today, I'm joined by someone truly special, someone who has not only inspired policies and projects, but also people. My guest today is Bronwyn Thornton. Many of you know her as the chief executive of Walk 21. Bronwyn, beyond that title, is a thought leader and also a tireless advocate for walkability as a basic human right. She has been leading conversations in major global conferences, but also at the city level. And what I admire the most about her is how she has shown through her leadership and through her work as a woman in mobility is that reimagining our streets is more than about transportation. It's also about dignity, about health, equity, and joy. So please join me in welcoming Bronwyn. Welcome to Next Stop.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here and to talk with you today. I'm very honored.
Thank you so much. Bronwyn, I have listened to you at many major conferences, and I also am aware about the work of Walk 21. You always talk to people, mayors, practitioners, urban planners about walkability, and you are a woman leader at the forefront of this walkability movement. Can you please tell us a little bit about the core mission that drives your work?
Sure, thank you. It is funny that you, with that introduction, because people actually used to say to me, she said, oh, here comes the woman for walking, right? I was always the woman for walking, and just me being in the room would actually create the conversation. I'm so thrilled now that I don't have to be there for people to talk about walking. But in those early days, I had to turn up just to even have it on the agenda. But for me, what drives me is how fundamental walking is. It's who we are, right? It's who we are as people. It's how we meet as individuals, as community. It's how we interact and rub along against each other in society. And walking is about everybody. I used to work in cycling for a short time, and cycling is a mode of travel. It's a great fun mode of recreation as well. But walking is a mode of living, and it's for everybody. It reaches everybody, but particularly the most vulnerable. And so it has something that is foundational. That is the foundation for me. It's for everybody. It's for the most vulnerable, particularly. And just quite frankly, it's so fascinating. It's so interesting. There's so many channels and agendas to work on that I'm inspired every day by the opportunity to work on this topic. And after 20 years, I'm still as passionate about it as the day I had my own epiphany and moved into this topic.
I really like how you said that walking is basically for everyone. Usually when people try to talk about promoting active mobility like walking and cycling, we talk about children, we talk about youth and women, but walking is truly for everyone. Actually, a few weeks ago, my nephew, who lives in Dubai, came to Jordan to spend the summer vacation with us. And what he truly enjoyed the most is taking short walks with my father. So and I really enjoyed seeing them, you know, like walking around. He was with all the enthusiasm of kids, pointing at birds, trees and bugs, which is where he should be, you know, where this should be natural to him. But because he lives in a city that is very car-centric, that puts vehicle movement first, he doesn't get the opportunity to be in contact with nature and also people his age and even his family. I think when we try to advocate for walkability, we talk about putting people first, right? And this means promoting walkable policies that talk about giving less space for cars. So I want to hear from you, what do you think of car-free cities? Is it a radical idea? And what would be a realistic way to define a vision for car-free cities so that it becomes a real policy target and more than just an activist slogan?
Yeah, it's a really fantastic anecdote you share there and challenge that we have, because we often talk about, and even in my own family, our kids used to say the car is freedom. But the car denies the freedom for so many other people to move independently and safely in their local communities, like your nephew can or like children can in terms of walking to school. And we've lost sight of the value of that walk. I remember a dad saying to me that the day he walked his daughter to school was the best start to his day in the whole week. So the value for that is not just the child, but for the adult as well. The challenge with an idea like car-free cities, mm-hmm. a city is a big place, right? It has to encompass rightly and organically, it does inevitably, the huge diversity of people, activities, mobilities, different urban contexts across the entirety of the city. And the challenge we face when people say, oh, you can't do a walkable city because you can't walk that far, is that they homogenize the concept. Because what we've done in our cities is that we've homogenized transport so that car dominance is the mode that people perceive as the best way to move around those cities. But cities are not homogenous. Our mobility offers cannot be homogenous. And so we need to create choice for everyone in the community with those different modes. So it's not about a car-free city, but it's about car light and car free in the most appropriate places. And there are a lot of those. Around the school gate is one of those. In our local community, so old people can leave their homes and walk to local shops. And so that even the office workers, the driving economy, because often we're told walking doesn't drive the economy. But in the middle of big cities, people need to come out of their offices and benefit from walking. Walking isn't just an economic activity or a transport activity, but it's a community and health activity, as I've said already. And you see in places like the Dead Center of London, the City of London, they're investing in walkable spaces for that economic community that's part of the city. So it's for all of those different elements of the city. And the other thing that's really important about a car-free city, which I'm not really comfortable with, I don't want a whole city to be one thing or the other, but is to think about, actually, we already have cities that have really low car ownership. Like India, only 7.5% of households own a car. But you wouldn't realize that with the investment that's happening in motorways and motorized travel. And in Mexico, less than 50% of households own cars. But again, the dominant hegemony is to provide for those cars. So what we have to identify is, where do we build best for walkability? So where can we ensure that walkable communities are there to enable the people who need to access their local community? So the children, the old people, I've said, people with mobility challenges, and then provide those journey extenders, which is like public transport, to move to other parts of the city. And I think the other thing about that is that we can still do a lot for walking without having an impact on cars. You know, we did a project in Portugal a couple of years ago where they made incredible improvements around the facilities for walking without impacting on the flow of traffic. Now, this is a challenge. We do need to think about traffic. I'm not denying the need for that. We need to manage speed. We need to manage their access and all those things. And we'll probably talk about that a little bit here today. But there is a lot we can do. It's not one or the other. We can find a balance between those things. We just have to recognize the importance of creating that balance in a very organic, heterogeneous cities that we live in and in our local communities.
Mm-hmm. So talking about car-free cities, or as you prefer to call them, car-light cities, is not necessarily about banning cars, but it's about rebalancing the priorities and understanding the mobility needs of the community. And if we look at the mobility patterns of people across different communities and different contexts, we can find that most trips are actually around caregiving. So, for example, if we have a working mother going back home from her office. She needs to pick up her child from the school and maybe run a few errands, buy something for the house to cook dinner before she gets home. So the journey doesn't only have like one objective or one destination, if we may say. So if we want to design car light strategies, what would be the core design principles that we need to prioritize in order to make sure that equity is at the foundation and not an afterthought, in order to address the needs of those different road users, old people, women, children, and young people?
Yeah, it's a really good, there's a lot in this question, Sana. It's the complexity, the simplicity of walking, but the complexity of providing for it. So let me pick up on a couple of things. So the way women move in our cities is different from the way men move. And you've highlighted that already in terms of these trip chaining care trips and these multiple aspects to their journeys. And in Ireland, they didn't, a few years ago now, the minister realized that she didn't understand this difference between how men and women move. And she commissioned a report which found that women are motorizing faster than men in Ireland. They are wanting to have private cars and using those cars much faster than men, because very often our public transport systems are built on a commute concept, an A to B journey, not an A, B, C, D, E, F journey that is a female journey. And so women were not able to do those care trips without private motorized travel. So they were getting into their cars to fulfill all those different demands on their journey. And then once you understand that that's what they're doing, then you have a different perspective on what the policy choices you can make to support women's movement and to address that imbalance. And if I could share another perspective on this sort of equity lens, and it's a study I read a couple of years ago. It was done by the World Bank, looking at the morning commute of men and women in Buenos Aires. And what they found was that men and women are both spending 45 minutes traveling to work. Mm-hmm. Well, that's equality. There we go. They're both spending the same amount of time traveling to work. But if you have those only a single KPI, then you are not getting to the actual grist of it, which is men are spending 45 minutes in a car very often, or in a vehicle, traveling on one leg of a journey from A to B into the office. And so they're going a long way to their working place, whereas women are spending that 45 minutes doing exactly what we've been talking about, which is dropping the children off, picking up some shopping, checking on an elderly relative before arriving at her workplace. So her 45 minutes is in a much smaller context. His 45 minutes is a longer journey. And if you don't understand this, then the traditional version of improving equity for those women is to give them access to the opportunities that exist within a 45-minute drive, rather than bringing those opportunities closer to home, so that mm-hmm. they don't have to use that same mode that the men do to access their work and all of their other responsibilities in the community. So that's where this conversation around women and equity has really lifted the lid on the choices that we make for our transport systems, which have historically been focused on the commute journey, on A to B travel, early in the mornings around peak hours, and not with this complexity of the multiplicity of what women have to do for their local journeys, and which is why walking is so helpful, because it's so much easier to drop off and to do these different things than in a car, or even cycling. I mean, I find moving on a bicycle much more flexible than in a car. So we have to peel back the data to see what it really says, and then understand how we can answer that, because women don't want to triple their commute time to fulfill all of those responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. I really find this angle that you brought interesting, because usually when we talk to experts on transportation, I think the buzzword is around 15-minute cities. And I was preparing for this episode. I found that it's a lightning rod for many conspiracy theories, that 15-minute cities actually limit people's mobility and limits their accessibility to where they live, and it doesn't necessarily have to be everything has to be very close to home, people enjoy actually walking, cycling, or even taking public transportation for longer distances because it gives them a sense of connection to the place, to the city where they were born, to the city where they live in, and also gives them a sense of adventure to explore new places that are not certainly close to home. And this is part of, you know, the everyday life that we want to experience. So what is your view on 15-minute cities? Do you think they are the answer? And are they truly pragmatic? And is there a way to measure that if they truly work, like neighborhood cities within that offer 15 minutes mobility for people? How do we know if it's truly livable or not?
Yeah, thank you for that. It's interesting because 15-minute cities has become very public right now. It's a label that's very highly, as you said, it's become a bit controversial. And in Scandinavia now, they're even designing 5-minute cities. For me, these are all just different political labels. So what we are talking about is walkable spaces. And also for us, a walkable city isn't just about within your local neighborhood, but it's also about the access to public transport to take you on those longer journeys. The other thing that the research shows is that if people have a nice environment, if it's a comfortable, safe place, people will walk further than 15 minutes because they enjoy it. If you measure people and the distances they walk in cities like London and New York and San Francisco, perhaps, people walk longer than that because it's a nicer place to walk and it's safe and comfortable. So for me, 15-minute cities is a current topic of conversation, but not the most critical one because it still comes down to walkable neighborhoods. And Japanese cities are a fantastic indication, you know, fantastic example of this. People talk about it all the time. They've got that fine-grained urban fabric at street level that allows people to walk, to access their local shops, to meet each other, to the children to go to school. And in terms of, but still having those public transport journeys to extend it and to take people to other parts of the city, or even to travel by car sometimes. I mean, we don't rule cars out altogether. It's about the choice that you're making as to when you take the car for that journey. The other, the factor though around KPIs is that there are all those physical infrastructure measures, right? Having safe space, safe crossings, crossing times is an important factor. We have a long list of environmental indicators, but the other one that we really support at Walk 21 is the personal satisfaction with that journey. What's your personal experience? Because we can engineer an environment, but people, if they still don't feel safe, then they are not going to choose to walk or to allow their children to walk in that community. So we really value not only getting all of the physical attributes right, and we're very well across all of those. We've mentioned some already, trees, protection from weather, all of these things are factors, but we also have to understand what those personal comfort, personal experiences are. And well, it's an unashamed plug, but just to share the work we're doing, which is through the Walkability app, we've designed explicitly to understand how people feel in their walkable communities, not just measure the technical environmental contributions or management of that environment.
Mm-hmm. I really like that you brought up the Walkability app and that you mentioned a lot of successful examples from cities around the world. And this showcases that it's important to talk to everyone that will be impacted by, you know, like implementing those car light strategies and making their neighborhoods more walkable. And I think that when we advocate for walkability, we have a lot of people who are super enthusiastic about it, like health professionals, maybe climate advocates as well, because of all the health and environmental positive impacts that it has on our well-being, our physical health, and also on the planet. But there are a lot of people who oppose walkability, mainly concerned about gentrification. Usually when neighborhoods transition to become more walkable, the housing and rent prices go up, and this basically makes the livability cost go higher. So many local communities after like a few years have to leave those neighborhoods because they no longer can afford to live there. What do you think is the reason for that? And how can we overcome this gentrification gap? And how can we address the concerns of merchants and freight operators who think that car light policies limit their accessibilities to their stores, limit the economic vitality of their projects, and are also concerned about many challenges that will come up, like delivery challenges and accessibility and whatnot?
Sure. Let me start with the gentrification and then we'll talk about the commercial and freight. The gentrification is such an interesting issue because so often people say, oh, walking is for poor people, or poor people are captured walkers. They don't have, you know, as soon as they might have a choice, they'll do something else. And yet in the same conversation, we end up with saying that creating better walkable environments is gentrification of those communities and makes them more valuable and more economically attractive. And so to me, this contradiction between making it nicer makes it more valuable, which suggests two things. One is that we should have walkability so widespread that you don't get that. Like everywhere is walkable, and then that reduces the value in a certain place, you know, like where if we only make certain neighborhoods more walkable and therefore more attractive, then obviously that you can't concentrate the resources into that space. So you have to do it at you have to do it both at scale, so lots of places are, and in fact in many, many countries and in the informal communities that we work in, many of those are very good walkable communities because they don't have motorized travel inside of them, and they have very active lots of active street frontages and space for children and people being on the street. But the urban context of that, you know, the health consequences of that, the economic sort of viability of that is very different. But on a technical measure, the walkability is high. And so we need to identify that walkability is not always about the most expensive infrastructure, but just about the essential provision of safe space, safe crossings, the ability for people to spend time on those streets. So walkability doesn't always have to mean expensive and fancy. And if we imagine that in that way and provide it more broadly, then you reduce that sort of that impact. The other thing about the commerce and the freight and things is this is something that you do have to address as a city, is how you manage those things. In Brisbane, when I was growing in my earlier years, we used to have a freight route go past through a local high street and past a local school. And to ask those trucks to divert, to go down a major road and come, like I think it added like a kilometre to their journey, was a massive political challenge. To ask that truck not to be driving through the heart of a community, or those multiple trucks accessing an industrial area, not to drive through the heart of the community, but to go around it on a more major route. And this is what I mean about the heterogeneity of the city, is that there's just no way a truck should be in that space. However, those commercial services on that street do require their deliveries. And the most successful ones I've seen are time delivery. So you have different times of day when different activities happen in the street. San Sebastian's a fantastic example of this. It's a huge walkable center of the city, all of it commercial retail centers, and they have deliveries in small vans up until 11 o'clock in the morning, and then the people come in after that as the numbers shift. And so that balance changes in the street based on the needs of the different access points. And so for those sorts of environments, central London is the same. They have lots of streets, not whole neighborhoods like in the whole city center, like in San Sebastian, but lots of streets, timed usage of those different streets. So lots of streets are turned over to markets and to community activities on weekends. So one street doesn't have to do everything for everybody all the time. The usage and the way that we manage those streets should be very flexible and very available. Where we allow the vehicles, like my example in Brisbane, These are dangerous vehicles to have in community spaces. And when those streets go through commercial centers, high streets, and past schools, these are community spaces. These are not freight routes. These are community spaces, and those sorts of scale of trucks, they're too dangerous for those spaces. So they should just be ruled out and not, that to me is a no, it's a no-brainer. So then you do, but I just want to address one last thing on this, because people say, well, then you displace the freight or those big trucks. And this is where the gentrification comes back as I'm looping around. You're displacing them onto a road, and that downgrades that neighborhood while you're prioritizing this neighborhood over here. And then that comes back to those citywide management practices around lowering speeds, managing access, things that we haven't been brave enough to do enough of historically, but we must start grappling with more and more. Is a lot of what we need to do to address these issues is actually how we manage the spaces that we make available, not how we rebuild them or repave them, but just how we manage that. And we have to sort of address that sort of default murderized access to everything or everywhere. And we see that in lots of different places. It's happening all the time, but we need to do more and more of it on the things that matter, like speed, like scale of vehicles, like the scale of roads. Even just the width of a road can impact on how fast a vehicle travels or how much right it has in the space, sense it has in the space, as opposed to how much right people feel that they have to occupy that space.
So basically, there are solutions and there are many ways where we can balance between economic vitality for the community and also the walkability needs. And I like what you said, that one street doesn't have to do everything at once. And actually, each street has different uses around the year. For example, some streets are busier around holiday seasons with commercial activities and festivals, and also around the summertime. But maybe the rest of the year, it could be changed to be more walkable, to respond to the needs of people who live on that street. This also brings me to my next question, that cities do not change only by design. There is a lot of political pushing, and there is a lot of economic layers that are linked to shaping our cities. Who do you think has the most political leverage to push for car-free cities or car-light cities, especially that now we are approaching the new decade on sustainable transport? Do you think climate advocates will have a stronger political agenda to push for walkability and for cycling? And are there any blind spots that we are missing in our current advocacy for walking from the environmental angle mainly?
Okay, your questions are always so enormous, and I'm trying to answer them in a very succinct way to capture the essence of a response. You're absolutely right. I mean, the lobbying, the need for recognition. I feel at the moment, I mean, we're just this year celebrating 25 years of Walk 21. We're having our 25th conference, and feeling very much that even the fact that we have continued and sustained, you know, for this long, and finding those allies and those partnerships that allows for that, and building up those different relationships across the different conversations. So for a long time, health was running the walking agenda and bringing the conversation to the table. And then we see that very often when women become mothers for the first time, they discover how awful the environment is for children or for themselves as pregnant women and women with prams. And then they become very good advocates for better streets and better air quality, especially around schools and for their children. Or road safety has historically, again, been a little bit too car-centric, but has the conversation around walking in the road safety agenda has evolved around the safe systems approach and building environments that make things safer for people. So it, and now the climate conversation and the environmentalists that you mentioned. So in terms of where that voice comes from or how we can leverage that for political impact, is always really challenging. But what I always come back to, and I'll talk more about the environment climate topic in a minute, is that you have to find what are the political levers of the people who have the power at the moment, because walking is part of so many solutions, and the capacity for walking to address the policy challenges that they're facing is so great that you just have to find if they're really running on an equity agenda or a road safety agenda, then we can find ways that walking can contribute to that conversation. And we have to be flexible, like walking is, to communicate that. And over the last few years, we've been really building the case for walking around the economic vitality for local communities, if you're local or your government is coming in and wanting to revitalize local communities, then enabling people to walk there is obviously a really great way for them to invest in that local space. And so with the climate agenda, again, national governments are looking for quick and easy solutions, because we all know that electric vehicles are not going to solve all of our problems. I mean, we must never underestimate how powerful the car lobby is to sustain both its sales and its occupation of our public space. And we have to keep plugging away at the different alternatives. And the latest version of that with the cars is the fact, the idea that EVs will solve everything. And we know that it won't. Every piece of research says that we have to do a multi-pronged approach. And part of that is enabling people to walk and cycle and use public transport as the sustainable transport decade is going to promote. But we still have to fight to put walking into that conversation. It's sort of said, but it's not as ingrained perhaps as the public transport and cycling. So we will continue to leverage that. One of the challenges that we have as to why that's hard is because we don't generate emissions that need to be reduced. We are already a carbon-free, mode. So we are an easy win, but we don't add to the calculation of carbon reductions or emission reductions. We can do that in packages between walking and public transport, because then you have the carbon emissions come from the public transport and the walking supports the ridership and the mode shift that's needed to access that public transport. So for a long time, transport couldn't get into the climate agenda very clearly. And I was in Paris when the agreements were all signed, and transport was a really small part of that conversation. And transport didn't get a sustainable development goal either. It's scattered across all of those other goals, but its role and its contribution to these conversations wasn't recognized or really well established in a lobbying process. And for a very long time, especially for the last 13 years since Paris, the environment departments in governments are writing the agendas for their climate responses, for their nationally determined contributions. And it's only more recently that we see transport departments trying to influence that. So we've had to lobby environment agencies as well as transport agencies to put active mobility into those nationally determined contributions. And then we go back to the transport agencies to get them to align their national policies with that climate agenda, so that you get that joined up thinking across government. And what we're hoping now, with the UN Decade of Sustainable Transport starting next year, is that we finally put the recognition of the importance of sustainable transport, the whole ecosystem, not just sustainable fuels, which is what electric vehicles are. Electric vehicles are sustainable fuel or energy systems, but sustainable transport systems is that whole ecosystem of walking, cycling, and public transport. And this decade gives us the opportunity to highlight that, to demonstrate that, and to recognize the value that walking and cycling and public transport makes to that agenda. So we will continue to position walking into that space and to see its value. But also, just quickly as a last point on this issue around environment, it's also around the air quality and the importance of heat reduction in cities. So walking and cycling allows for more space to be given over to sustainable urban drainage systems, for green infrastructure corridors, for trees, and for an entire better quality of public space that is currently dominated by vehicle movement or the occupation of that space by motorized travel. So the environmental dimensions of this are multifold. The lack of emissions, the value of supporting low emission systems like public transport, but then also the liberation of space that comes from more walking and cycling that allows us to build green infrastructure and trees and public spaces into our cities to support those local communities and better mobility choices.
Actually, this is exactly what we are trying to do at Next Stop, breaking down the role of transportation in enhancing the achievability of climate targets, environmental targets, and also the, highlight the benefits on health and well-being. I think transportation has been like hiding behind energy, behind SDG 11, sustainable cities, and it was never like held accountable as a sector to achieve climate targets and health and well-being targets. And what you brought up is basically what everyone is trying to achieve and within the climate agenda to make the planet livable for people. With the increasing temperature and with the increased air pollution, our cities are becoming toxic and not livable anymore. But if you want to move forward from this global framework to the grassroots level, if you were advising a mayor who's still learning about sustainable transport and walkability, and if he had like a limited budget to do a small pilot project, what would you advise him to do? What would be the pilot that you would recommend that would prove the case for a car-free transformation or car-light transformation?
Yeah, I think sometimes you should ask my colleague Jim Walker about this because he loves advising mayors. But we never lack for ideas about where to start. But one of the things that we feel is really important, actually, is not find the easiest place. We used to say go for the low-hanging fruit or one of these expressions because it's very easy to do a lot for walking without having to confront the car lobby, you know, in terms of improving crossings, as we said, or improving just the quality of footpaths and things like that. But what I really feel with this idea is that you need to do it where people need it the most, not where it's easiest. Okay, so we have this conversation, particularly in communities where there's a big disparity between some of the economics of those different communities. And so very often it's easy to put in some wider footpaths in wealthier communities than in poorer communities. And so you're not really having an impact where people need it the most. And so we did a project in Lagos a couple of years ago, and we identified that the new bus station didn't have pedestrian access. You couldn't even get into it as a person. You could only get into it as a bus, and yet it was a bus stop. But around the bus station, there was a school and a hospital and no sidewalks. Mm-hmm. And so these are places where people really need to be able to walk and to access those things. And so don't just do it where it's easy. And very often European cities are like this. They'll start with a waterfront because it's not wrong to start with these things. Let me be clear. Creating beautiful waterfronts to people enjoy public space, to learn how lovely it is and to come out and then understand that they could have more of that. It's not wrong to do it in shopping centres where you get high volumes of pedestrians. In fact, it's very right to do it there because that's your customer base for that retail centre. But if you really want to do a pilot, do it where people need it the most and make sure that you measure before and after in really effective ways. And part of me feels perhaps even let's not worry about doing pilots, but if we know that it needs to be done, like this case in Lagos, just build the sidewalks. Just go and build the sidewalks and measure that impact. I know they can't always be done quickly, fair enough. So pilots can be done quickly. But the other critical thing about a pilot is to make sure it's nice. It's always really important that whatever you do is attractive to people so that they can see the value of what you've done. I know during COVID, a lot of communities did some very rapid interventions to increase street space for people walking and cycling, but they didn't do it very nicely. They put it out with big lumpy road highway building sort of barriers and things like that. So people resented it because it was both ugly and reminded them of COVID. So for me, do it where people need it, not just the easiest place. Make sure it looks good and make sure you measure the human experience before and after that space and value those voices. Value that local voice, not just the louder car lobby voice, that often can overwhelm those local voices that have really benefited from that experience.
So basically, do it where people need it the most. I'm gonna remember those words if I become the mayor of my city. This brings me to the last stop in this virtual ride. I really enjoyed it so much, Bronwyn. But I would like to ask you, where are you headed next? What is your next stop as a professional leading the walkability movement? And also as Walk21, I know you are planning for your conference next month. So maybe you want to tell us a little bit about that.
Sure, let me share with that. So we are having our Walk21 conference in Tirana in early October. And as I said, it's our 25th. It's Walk21, 25 years. So we have a sense of celebration about that, because sustaining, an organization and a community and a movement across 25 years has been both challenging and rewarding. And Tirana is such an interesting city because it's on the cusp of being ruined by motorization. Absolutely, they have the right to have cars, but how they choose to introduce them into the city and in all the things we've been talking about, and they're wrestling with school streets, they're wrestling with creating spaces for children and making those environments, and also maintaining access for people from a low car ownership households. So it's a really vibrant cultural city. We're looking forward to that. That challenge of cities on the cusp of development. We've worked a lot in cities that are very well developed, like Vienna or across Canada and places like that. Cities that have got huge amounts of sprawl, or poorer cities like in Kigali, and how we address walking in those different places. But it's as much as it's a different place and it's got some really interesting things, the basics don't change. How we deliver for walking, how we value walking, it's the same across all of our communities around the globe, which is why we feel so honored to bring that voice for all of those people, because if we want to ask people to walk, we have to make it really great. And you can't just imagine that happens by chance. Providing for walking is complicated. So we start with the conference next month, which is such a great time to reconnect, energize with our community, celebrate the successes of everybody who's coming to be there, but also setting agendas for what the next challenge is. How do we bring walking as a significant component of the UN Decade for Sustainable Transport, while continuing to support the decade around road safety and all of the other issues that we have? And we're going to continue working into the national government responsibility space, translating the agenda from those global imperatives down through national governments, identifying their opportunities, supporting broad regional master plans for walking that enable national governments to take responsibility for walking, and then layering that down to local authorities, local communities, and supporting people at street level. We never like to keep our heads up in the cloud of the global agenda, but to stay grounded with our feet in local communities and working with children, with public transport operators, with road safety communities in Africa, to measure that experience of people walking and to translate that into data that can communicate to practitioners the changes that that people need. So we're busy. We've got plenty to do. We walk fast at Walk21 to keep up with all of these different agendas, but we do it in partnership, and we do love that sense of both urgency to do something, but also the reward that comes when we connect with people and see the changes that they're making in their communities all over the world.
Well, I'm not going to be walking with you this year in Tirana, but I'm going to wish you and the team all the best of luck in the planning and the execution of the event. And to everyone that will be attending in person, it's going to be an amazing platform to network and to connect with like-minded people who root for walking. And I'm going to be rooting for all of you here from Jordan. Thank you so much, Bronwyn. It was a brilliant conversation. I want to also thank everyone watching this episode. Please let us know in the comments, what is the reality like in your city? Is your city walkable? Would you call for a car light strategy in your city? And how can we all make that measurable reality? Thank you so much for watching. Please follow us on Instagram, Tumi Initiative and also Sana_Khasauna in the links that will be added to the description box. Until next time.